I call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 4th, 2020, and the time is 1:35. Members present, Representative Knopf, Representative Laban, Representative Telton, Representative Carpenter's been excused, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Wool, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Representative Jennifer Johnston. Today's agenda is House Bill 79 by Representative Kopp, and we plan to hear and hold this bill. House Bill 79, we last heard this bill on Monday, March 2nd, where we adopted a new CS version O. We now have an actuarial analysis and updated fiscal note for your consideration. I'd like to go through both of these, hear the sectional analysis, and set the bill aside. I'd like to announce that the amendments for HB 79 are due Friday, March 6th at 5 p.m. Would Representative Kopp and his staff, Mr. Tuitt, like to come up to the table and briefly address the CS?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Chuck Kopp, House District 24, with me is my staff, Ken Truitt, and Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, could I also have Tom Westcott join me here?
And just for your information, we'll, if you just give a brief overview of the CS, and then we will have the actuarial analysis and the fiscal note, and then do a sectional after that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will have Mr. Truitt deliver the CS overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp. And I can be exceedingly brief. We covered the CS and the changes on Monday when we were before you. The only difference between this version and the version that we were speaking about on Monday is I think you have before you backslash O, and that's the only difference of the CS. It's identical to backslash G, which we talked about on Monday.
Okay, thank you. And actually, if you'd like, you could briefly again introduce what the bill does.
Yes, yes, Madam Chair. House Bill 79 introduces a hybrid defined benefit pension system that has three cost-saving features. The plan falls into three categories: a cost-saving features, plan asset enhancement adjustments, and plan benefit reductions. The cost-saving features, briefly, Madam Chair, is there is no retirement medical insurance. The medical benefit is the same as Tier 4, which is a health reimbursement arrangement. There is a fixed age of retirement, which is age 55, with 20 years of service. So no matter if you have your 20 years of service in at 41 years old or 42 or 44, you will wait till 55 to draw your benefit instead of the current plan, which is 20 years of service, you're eligible immediately, or 60 years with at least 5 years of service. The retirement income average is the consecutive high five salary years instead of 3 years, which is how it is in prior PERS tiers. There is no cost of living adjustment. The plan asset enhancements are that the employee contribution rate can be increased if the market requires that to stay funded at 90% funded. The employer contribution to the employee retirement benefit of 22%, with 12% mandatory to the employee benefit and the remaining 10% to the current plan unfunded liability. And then finally, Madam Chair, the plan benefit reductions include the post-retirement pension adjustment may be withheld if the plan funding is less than 90%. So those are briefly a description of the hybrid plan. It is a hybrid because the benefit is certainly guaranteed in the sense of a medical benefit, or previous plans had very minimal risk for the pension and the risk sharing. This significantly more risk transferred to the employee.
Okay, thank you. And I understand that we have Mr. David Kirshner with Buck Global Online. Are you there, Mr. Kirshner?
Yes, David Kirshner from Buck is here.
And could you walk us through the actuarial analysis, please?
Sure. The analysis involves projections of potential contributions to the PERS system, both currently and after the adoption of HB 79. And we have done those projections under three different economic scenarios. The first scenario is one where assets earn what we expect them to earn based on the ongoing funding of PERS, which is an annual rate of 7.38%. And then scenario two is we introduced a below expected return for 5 years, the five-year period FY21 through FY25. And we used 5.75%, which is the average return that was actually earned by the plan over the last 5 years, ending in 6/30/19. And then we introduced scenario three, which admittedly is not a very likely scenario, but we had to create some pretty poor asset returns to kick in to generate some of the levers that are inherent in the bill, like the reduction of the PRPA, the post-retirement pension adjustment, if the plan falls below 90%. So that's what scenario three represents. In the fiscal note, there are two pie charts that I'd like to walk through, because I think the pie charts really simplify the analysis as best we can. These pie charts show the distribution of the 22% statutory employer contribution rate for the members who are affected by HB 79. So this includes all the current peace officer firefighter members who are in the DCR plan, plus the new entrants that are expected to replace them as they exit the population.
Madam,
so currently,
excuse me, 1 minute, Mr. Kirshner, do you need an at ease?
Yes,
at ease. I call this meeting back to order. I'm sorry, Mr. Kirshner. Folks needed a color copy of the pie charts. Thank you for your patience. Could you again discuss the pie charts?
Okay, yes, thank you. So there's two pie charts, and what we're trying to represent here is in each case the employer contribution per statutes is 22% of pay, and the current 22% of pay, which is in the top, the first pie chart, shows how that 22% of pay is distributed. So I'd like to walk through each of the sections. The yellow section, the 1.8%, that's the and all of these percentages are a percentage of the pay for members who are affected by HB 79. So the yellow piece, the 1.8%, that's the contribution that is currently projected for FY 22 toward the DCR trusts, and that's for the occupational death and disability benefits and the retiree medical benefits that members of the DCR plan receive. The green slice, 3%, that's the average HRA contribution that employers make for all members of the DCR plan, 3%. And then the brown or maroon piece, the 5%, that's the current employer contribution that's made to the defined contribution accounts, the individual defined contribution accounts for members of the DCR plan. And the remainder of the 22%, which is the orange slice, the 12.2%, that's the amount that goes toward paying down the unfunded liability in the existing PERS, the PERS DB plan that covers pre-July 2006 hires. So if you add up all those four percentages, you get 22%. So now we move down to the second pie chart, and now after HB 79 is adopted, the green piece is the same as currently, because the employers will still contribute 3% toward the HRA accounts for these members. Then the yellow piece, which is 9%, the HB 79 provides a minimum 12% employer contribution. So with 3% being contributed to the HRA trusts, that leaves 9% of the 12% to contribute toward the HB 79 trust that is going to be set up. And so that totals 12%. So the remainder of the 22%, which is 10%, is the amount that would go toward the, to pay down the unfunded liability in the DB plan. So in the top pie chart, the amount going to pay down the unfunded liability in FY22 is 12.2% of pay, and that's reducing to 10% after HB 79. So that decrease of 2.2% has to be made up by the additional state contributions, and that's what is causing the increase in the additional state contributions, because the contribution that's needed to fund the existing DB plan is not changing. What's changing is how much of the pay for these active members is being used to pay down the unfunded liability of that plan. And because it's decreasing from 12.2 to 10%, that decrease has to be made up, and that's made up by the state via the additional state contributions. And then we would see a similar pie charts to this if we looked at every other year. This is the first year that HB 79 would be effective, so the other years would be similar.
And,
any questions about the pie charts?
Are there any questions about the pie chart? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, the dark section on the top pie chart, which is the defined contribution from the employer, where is that made up? Is that made up in the yellow in the below chart of the, where's that made up? The missing?
Well, with HB 79, under HB 79.
Oh, I see. I get it. Yep.
I'm sorry?
No, I see one is with and without HB 79, so I got it.
Correct. Under HB 79, these participants would no longer receive the DC account contributions,
right,
because they would now be receiving a defined benefit,
right,
pension rather than a defined contribution pension.
Any other questions? So I don't see any other questions. Would you like to continue, please?
Yes. So the other thing I'd like to, does everyone have a copy of the 20-year projection of additional state contributions that we provided?
Yes, I think it should be in your second page. It's up there on the screen there for folks.
Right, so I'm looking at something that's titled State of Alaska PERS 20-year projection of additional state contributions, and there are three different scenarios.
It seems that everybody has them. Thank you.
Okay. So let me first define the scenarios, which are shown in note two at the bottom of that page. In all cases, we reflected the actual return that the PERS DB plan experienced for the fiscal year ending 6/30/19, and that was about 6%. So 6% in FY19 was assumed in all three cases, and then we varied the returns assumed in future years. So scenario one is we assumed that the current expected return that's used to fund PERS, which is 7.38%, we assumed that would be the return earned by the assets every year going forward, starting in FY20. Then in scenario two, we said what happens if in FY21 through FY25, so over that five-year period, the actual return in those 5 years was only 5.75. And again, the 5.75 is based on actual historical experience for the 5 years ending 6/30/19. So it's not an out-of-the-question scenario that this scenario could conceivably materialize. And then after FY25, we assumed, again, 7.38%. And scenario three is a rather draconian scenario, and it's probably not very likely that this scenario would materialize, but we have to create a very poor asset return scenario in order to generate some sizable increases in additional state contributions. So we chose a 0% return in each of the 5 years for FY21 through FY25, and then a 2% return for each of the next 5 years, and then 7.38% going forward. So if we look at the current column, so this is before HB 79, you can see the projected additional state contribution under if assets earn 7.38% in every year for FY22, it's projected to be just under $198 million. And if we only earned 5.75% in FY21, that would cause the additional state contribution in FY22 to increase to about $201.5 million. And then if we earn 0% in FY21, you can see in the scenario three column. So those three columns are the projected additional state contributions under the current plan arrangement under these three different scenarios. And you can see, if you look at the 20-year total numbers, going from scenario one to scenario two increases the additional state contributions by about $1.8 billion over that 20-year period, and then rather dramatically under scenario three. Then we move to the middle set, which is the HB 79, and we do the same thing, but now we reflect the provisions of HB 79, which include the redistribution of the employer contributions that we just discussed in those pie charts. And you can see scenario one over the 20 years increases by roughly $100 million from $4.3 billion to $4.4 billion. And then scenario two over the 20 years is not a measurably different number. It's projected over the 20 years to be about another $2 million over that 20-year period. And then you can see what happens in scenario three. And the reason why we see the large numbers pop up in 2040 and 2041 is because the cumulative effect of these very poor asset returns means that contribution rates increase considerably, and combined with what's happening with HB 79, which, as we just saw with the pie charts, less money is going into the DB trust, so the additional state contributions have to make up that difference, and that's generating those large numbers in the later years, because the contribution rates are significantly higher in the future, and the additional state contribution is just the difference between the actuarially determined contribution rate and the 22% statutory rate. So I think the main message that I think everyone should come away from is that HB 79, as we saw in the two pie charts, because less money from the HB 79 group payroll is going to be directed toward the DB plan, because less is going to the DB plan, that shortfall has to be made up by the additional state contribution. So that's question number one. I mean, point number one. So costs will increase because of that. And then the other important message that I'd like everyone to be aware of is when the DB plans were closed in 2006 and there was a shifting toward a defined contribution arrangement, as everyone is probably aware, when you shift the benefits from a defined benefit arrangement to a defined contribution arrangement, that shifts the risk of investment returns from the state or the employer to the individuals, because in a defined contribution arrangement, you get a certain amount of pay, 5% every year, that goes into their accounts, and they invest it however they invest it, and then whatever happens to those investments, that determines how much money is left in the funds for the members when they retire. In the defined benefit world, when assets don't earn what we expect them to earn and creates deficiencies in the assets, those deficiencies have to be made up, not by the employees, but by the employer, and in this case, because of the statutory 22% rate, that deficiency falls to the state. So a combination of less money going into the DB plan and the risk of future returns being less than what are projected, that risk, that's an increase in the risk to the state that higher contributions will be needed in the future, and you can see that from those 20-year projections under the different scenarios.
So in sort of to sum up, in our current arrangement with employers other than state, the employers pay the 12.2% for all employees, including the defined contribution employees, towards the unfunded liability. And where you're noting the short, the added liability is the fact that this plan changes the 12.2% to 10% of that 22% that each employer pays to the state. Is that correct?
To the defined benefit plan.
To the defined benefit plan, to the unfunded liability.
Yes, correct.
Are there any questions? Representative Kopp.
For the presenter, Madam Chair, if I may. Mr. Kirshner, I did not hear you comment on the difference, House Bill 79, that the risk you say that is pushed to the employer, that risk is shared with the employee in this plan. Is that not correct?
Well, there is some, yes, there is some risk sharing that that is passed along to the employees under HB 79. The member contribution rate starts at 8% of pay for the members, the HB, the Peace Fire members who are affected by HB 79. And if the funded status of the HB 79 bill has two features in it that kick in if and when the funded status, which is a comparison of the assets to the liabilities of the HB 79 trust, falls below 90%. The first thing is the post-retirement pension adjustments that would be otherwise available to participants are cut back. And the second one is that the Retirement Management Board has the authority to increase that 8% employee contribution to something higher than 8%, but no more than 10%. So somewhere between 8 and 10%, the board could adopt a higher contribution rate if the funded status of the HB 79 trust falls below 90%.
Thanks. Mr. Kirshner, with your previous actuarial on just this hybrid itself, if my memory serves me correctly, you showed that to the hybrid program itself, there was a limited liability of increasing our unfunded liability. Is that correct?
If you could please clarify what you mean by hybrid.
This HB 79, we're at this point calling it a hybrid program. So I should just say for HB 79, I think you showed that the program itself managed well would not add to the unfunded liability. Is that correct? In other words, the program contained in itself, we're not talking about what it does to the employer's contributions, but the program contained in itself. But with this actuary report, what you're saying is that there is a liability, an increased liability to the state as far as the payment with the other employers for the unfunded liability. And I'm not sure if I've made that clear.
That's correct. And it's because, again, going back to the pie chart, because a smaller portion of the compensation for this group is going to be deposited to the defined benefit plan trust to pay down that unfunded liability, that shortfall has to be made up by someone because the unfunded liability in the defined benefit plan is what it is. And so if less if there's less coming from the employers of these peace fire members toward that unfunded liability, someone has to make up that shortfall, and it's the state via the additional state contributions.
And just for finance members who haven't been eating, sleeping, and drinking this for a number of years, are you all clear of the difference between the employers and the state and what we're talking about? The employers are municipalities, the university, and when the defined benefit program was closed and there was quite a large unfunded liability, it was then the employers for a year or so actually had to pay their full amount of that unfunded liability, and then the state did kick in and say they capped it at 22%. And so what this actuary report does is it says because of this bill, this population will be paying less into that unfunded liability. Is that all clear? Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Wall?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did hear this bill pre-change about a year ago, so it's not super fresh in my mind. So the unfunded liability was created when we went from a DB to a DC plan. So that's still hanging out there. Part of this scenario is paying down the unfunded liability of that change. And that would have to happen anyways. I guess one question is how, if this plan would pay into that unfunded liability, how else, if this plan wasn't enacted, how would we be paying down the unfunded liability? Is that happening through the DC plan currently?
And Representative Wall, if you look at the pie charts, the current pie chart, the top pie chart, is how it's currently being handled. So the university pays X amount or percentage of the 22% for all employees, be them defined benefit or defined contributions. And so that's what you're looking at currently in for the pie chart that's on top. And we can have actually Department of Administration, if you wouldn't mind switching seats to come up and further clarify this for everyone.
Madam Chair, may I just offer one related to Mr. Representative Wohl's comment is, and your question, I think, well laid it out, Madam Chair, that the plan by itself is structurally very sound and does not add to the liability, but it's the existing liability that actually acts as a weight on it. The plan itself, according to this Mr. Kirshner, is projected to be 99.3% funded if this bill would have been enacted last year by the summer of this year, and that it's expected to improve every year. In other words, get above 100% because the contribution rate significantly exceeds what they recommend the contribution rate to be to the plan. So I just wanted the committee members to know that the plan on its own is structurally very sound. We just have this unfunded liability demon we're wrestling with. Thank you.
But with that said, one of the reasons the plan is structurally sound is that there is a decrease in the payment towards the unfunded liability. It goes from 12 to 10%. So, yes. But yes. Could Kathy Lee and Kevin Worley, I think they're both here, come up and introduce yourself. And who you represent.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. But before we, I don't know if the gentleman's still on the line, but I guess, can I ask a question about this scenario 1, 2, and 3?
Mm-hmm. Are you still on the line, Mr. Kirshner?
Yes, I am.
Representative Wohl has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the three scenarios and the differences and basically the return of the funds. And scenario one and two at the end of 20 years is about the same, and the fund has a lower return for looks like 5 years. Scenario three has a zero return for 5 years and a 2% return for the next 5 years. So it's, as you said earlier, pretty draconian. How would this affect, if that scenario were to happen and HB 79 wasn't enacted, how would that affect, the defined contribution aspect of the current system, and would that affect the paying back of the unfunded liability in any way, or does that just fall on the state?
This is David Kirshner from Buck. Yes, it falls to the state because the employers are going to contribute 22% of pay regardless, and the excess of the actuarially required rate and the 22% is what falls into the additional state contribution. So if you look, to answer your question, if you look at the first three columns under the current plan, you can see this is not adopting HB 79, so just current plan provisions. If we were to experience draconian scenario three, you can see what happens to the additional state contributions over the next 20 years. They increase pretty significantly. Over the 20 years, it's an extra $10 billion of contributions that the state would have to contribute over and above the 22% employer contributions. And that's because these draconian asset returns create such large increases in the unfunded liability that has to be made up over 25 years per the funding policy that the board has adopted.
Yep, I see it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So actually we've kind of floated into your fiscal note here back and forth, and could you please present the fiscal note for the committee. Thank you.
Sure. Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The fiscal note, excuse me, because this provision does not take into effect until fiscal year 22, July 1, 2021, the additional state contribution increase would be $3.5 million, increasing to 4.1 through fiscal year 2026.
Are there any questions?
Can you repeat that? Sorry.
No problem.
I was looking at a pie chart.
No problem. So because this provision doesn't kick in until fiscal year 2022, the initial contribution would be $3.5 million. And if you're looking at this chart here that's on the wall, it's under scenario one, increase due to HB 79. And as Mr. Kirshner had discussed, because of that shift of the DC contribution from the 12.2% down to 10% by the implementation of this bill, the state additional state contribution would increase by these amounts under scenario one through the tune of 99.8 million over or through 2039.
This is 100 million after 20 years if the stock market does like it's doing that.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson, I was about to get concerned, no questions.
It's not history.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but that's a compliment to me, so you're going to feed the fire if you do that. Through the chair, I guess for this, for the staff here, but maybe not, maybe for for Mr. Truitt. Can someone remind me if a firefighter was first employed in 2007 and they want to transition into this in 2022, how they would go about doing that?
Kathy Lee with the Division of Retirement and Benefits, Chief Pension Officer. The bill provides Representative Josephson through the chair for a transition process whereby we would look at the members' age, their amount of service they need to purchase, and what their account is in the DC plan. The actuary would calculate what is needed to purchase that same amount of service in the defined benefit plan. If there is insufficient funds to buy all of the service, then we would calculate how much is paid up, and the rest of the service would be there for the member to pay off in the future should they choose. If there was excess funds over what they need to purchase the service in the DB plan, that excess would remain in their defined contribution account.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'll apologize, Ms. Lee. I'm probably a little slower than the rest of the group here. But, so could you give me a practical example? So let's just take a hypothetical. So if you're, say we had an employee that started in 2007. He's 25 years old. And so you can do the math at this point. So we're into 2007, you go to 22, what do we got, 15 years, 14 years of service. So what I'm curious about, the crux of my question is, what's an employee looking like to buy in? So if he's got 14 years of service instead of 25, he's now 39. I'm doing off my head math here. So he's 39, 14 years of service, trying to buy in. What would what would be the max if he contributed the max to the defined contribution plan now? It's pretty easy to figure out what he'd have in there, what it would cost him to buy in. So I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. What's an employee looking at to buy into this plan using a hypothetical scenario like that?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, that's not an easy calculation to do off of the top of my head. But what I would say is the information we've received back from Buck indicates that the majority of the DC participants will be able to purchase their service. There will be a few outliers, and those are the folks that are closer to retirement because they have a shorter period of time in which to gain on the plan investments in that way. But generally, what we understand is that their DC accounts will cover the service they want to purchase.
Follow up?
No, but I thank you for that because that's kind of what I suspect, and that people closer to retirement would have a little easier time getting in. Okay, thank you. I'll leave it at that.
Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Right now, we have state employees, PERS and TERS, that fell under Tier 1, 2, and 3. And if you were fortunate to be under Tier 1, most of that population probably has reached retirement age. Maybe there's a few left. I don't know, but not very many. And then, of course, Tier 2 and Tier 3 have more employees still in that fund. Is that population the group that's dealing with the unfunded liability, and how big is that unfunded liability today?
We're at about Kevin Worley, through the chair to Representative Laban, we're at about $5 billion.
$5 billion? Yeah. So does HB 79, is it neutral to that $5 billion, or is it helping to make up that shortfall in some indirect way?
I would have to defer to Mr. Kirshner on that one.
Had the question?
Hi, David Kirshner from Buck. The answer to your question is it doesn't do anything to the existing to that $5 billion existing unfunded liability. What it does is it affects how much of the employer contributions are going to be used to pay down that unfunded liability. And again, that goes back to the pie charts. Currently, we're in FY22, about 12.2% of the pay for these members is going to help pay down that $5 billion unfunded liability. After HB 79, only 10% of their pay would be going toward that unfunded liability. So it doesn't change the unfunded liability. All it does is it changes who's going to pay down that unfunded liability. After HB 79, more burden on that to pay down that existing unfunded liability falls to the state, which is why we see the increase in the additional state contributions of roughly $3.5 to $4 million per year for the next 5 years.
Follow up.
Yes, follow up. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess in my mind, that's the elephant in the room, is that unfunded liability of $5 billion and the rate in which we are closing that gap, so that when all these folks that are out there, tiers 1, 2, and 3, have collectively as a group hit retirement age, we're meeting the expectation of the retirement, that there's sufficient funding for health insurance and retirement benefits, and how comfortable do we feel like we're on the right path to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Laban, the ARM board has taken on the funding policy, and through the ARM board in conjunction with the state, through the additional state contributions, that plan has us virtually paid off by 2039, 2040. So we would be 100% funded at that time. I'll just stick with the current scenario. That's where we're at right now.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So with HB 79, we are, or if you care to express an opinion, we are comfortable with the financial reality that we're not going to repeat what happened in tiers 1, 2, and 3, and that this model offers reasonable financial stability to the state and municipalities, that in 15, 20 years from now, we're not looking at a sizable unfunded liability. Do you have an opinion about that?
Representative Laban, I think we saw the actuarial report for this plan earlier, and it did have it. I think it was over 90%. Funding and with most plans, if you're over 80, you're somewhat stable. Representative Colleen Leonard-Sullivan. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam.
He's sitting next to me.
I have a quick question with regard to a comparison between the PERS DCR and HB 79O version. I'm looking at the medical benefits, and can you give me what the comparison is between what the employees have presently compared to what is in the present bill?
Through the chair, Representative Solomon Leonard, this bill adopts the same health plan as the defined contribution retirement system currently has. And that is a health plan that is an 80-20 cost share. The premiums are based on how many years of service you have. There's a percentage that the employee pays towards the premium, but it's the same plan as they have in the DC right now.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to tail back to Representative Laban's questioning, define it, I guess, as best you can define it, whether or not we move forward with HB 79, it doesn't have, not going to have any impact on the unfunded liability question, or is that correct? It won't have an impact on the unfunded liability question?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, correct.
Okay. Yes.
What it does impact is the additional state contribution or the funding plan that the Arm Board and has in place to pay off the unfunded liability through 2039. Under scenario one, we're going to see an increase, again, because of that pie chart example that Mr. Kirshner spoke to earlier, because less is going in from the Peace Officer Firefighter Trust.
Okay.
Yeah. So that shifts additional money. Yes.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
And then follow up. In terms of the fiscal note and the figures going out to FY 2026, are those solid figures? Are they estimate figures? What degree of variability are those in those figures?
I'll have to defer to Mr. Kirshner on that one.
Yes, David Kirshner from Buck. All projections are based on a set of assumptions about what's going to happen in the future. And so the figures that you see in scenario one, for example, the 5 years that are shown in the fiscal note, that's assuming that all future years we don't have any unexpected surprises on either the assets or the liabilities of the plan. And so what can cause unexpected surprises? The most obvious thing is if assets don't earn what we are expecting them to earn, which is 7.38%, if assets earn less than 7.38% in any future year, then the unfunded liabilities will be more than what we are projecting them to be, which would therefore result in higher additional state contributions than we projected. And then on the liability side, there are a number of things that can affect the liabilities. If people retire at different ages or patterns of retirement than we projected, or if people live longer than our mortality assumption assumes, all of those potential events could cause future assets and liabilities to be either greater or less than we're projecting. And that would impact our projected figures that you see in the fiscal note, because our projected figures assume that all future experience matches what our expectations are.
Thank you for that. One more question.
Follow up.
And in relationship to the 20-year projection of additional state contributions under scenario three, is there any probability that we can look at what the likelihood would be of scenario three? Is it just kind of like a random? In other words, what likelihood is there of scenario three? That's what I'm trying to get at.
This is David Kirshner from Buck. It was a fairly random scenario, and it was generated so that we would see some. Let me take a step back. Under scenarios one and two, the projected funded status of the HB 79 trust is projected to be at least 90%. So we wanted to create a scenario that would drop that funded status below 90%, which would then kick in some of the cost-saving measures that are in the bill, like the elimination of the post-retirement pension adjustment benefits. So we created scenario three, admittedly has a low probability. I guess the easiest way I would answer that is if we were sitting in the year 2000 or 2002, and somebody had said, what do you think is going to happen to the markets in 2008? I don't think anybody would have ever reasonably predicted a 20 to 30% decline in the asset markets in 2008, yet that's what happened. So low probability for sure, but nobody can really say for sure. There's no real way to quantify the probability of that happening, but it is rather small to generate a 0% return for 5 years and a 2% return for 5 years. But this, albeit unlikely scenario, illustrates what it would take to generate some sizable increases in the additional state contributions due to the adoption of HB 79 over and above what would currently be expected under that scenario.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it looks like from the chart that in 2040, the unfunded liability will be paid off at its current rate. Is that correct, Mr. Kirchner?
It's actually not quite paid off, the reason why the additional state contribution is zero is because whatever contributions are required in those years, those would be covered by, those are less than 22%. So any contributions would be met by the employer contribution, and nothing additional would be required by the state.
Follow up. You said 22. Did you mean 12.2, or is that you're still at 22? Because 22 is the entire.
Representative Wall, when there were some changes made to the plan a couple of years ago, when the state did additional deposits, and this plan, this meant employers would be basically doing what I call the tail of the unfunded liability. So that's why he's saying this is under 22%. The state wouldn't be participating anymore.
Thank you. Follow up, please. We see scenario 1, 2, and 3, depending on sort of returns. Is there a scenario where the state wouldn't pay additional based on an exceptionally good return year? Does that make sense?
Did you hear that, Mr. Kirchner?
Yes, I did. Currently, the current contribution rate for FY22 is projected to be about 29.5% of pay. And now that includes some contribution to the DCR plan. So that's what we are currently projecting for FY22. And then that's projected to stay in the 30% range for the next several years. It would take some pretty significant positive or favorable asset returns, like in the double-digit teen percentages, for a number of years to bring the contribution rate down below the 22% statutory rate, which would eliminate the additional state contributions. But it would take some pretty amazing years of asset returns to generate that scenario.
Okay, thank you.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to take another stab at my misguided question, and that is, should the plan have an unfunded liability? This is Senate Bill 79, House Bill Senate 9. Do you have an opinion regarding the effectiveness of the adjustment mechanism with employer and employee contribution rates in this bill? In other words, the ability to adjust and correct itself during the life of the plan? Do you have an opinion?
I would defer to David on that one, too. Because we've looked at the looked at the mechanisms.
Yeah, as I said, the HB 79 trust is starting out essentially at 100% funding, and even with the five bad years that we simulated in scenario two, the funded status of the HB 79 trust is still projected to be over 90% in the 20 years that we looked at, even with those five bad years of returns. So, you know, the lowest funded percentage is in the about 90, looks like about nine, just under 99% funded. So it would take a lot to generate a funded percentage below 90%, which is when these additional cost-saving measures kick in. So I would say that the HB 79 bill is fairly secure in the sense that it has some pretty good safeguards built in to prevent the contribution rate from skyrocketing. But as the pie charts show, even without those adverse returns, we're still shifting some money away from the DB plan from the employers that has to be made up by the state. So even with the safeguards, we're still faced with some additional state contributions that are increasing in the $3 to $4 million range, as we've shown. It would take a lot for the HB 79 trust to become, you know, a poorly funded plan. It's pretty unlikely that that would happen based on the measures that are in place in the bill.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The existing PERS, TERS, Tier 1, 2, and 3 plans, that $5 billion unfunded liability, there was a deposit made to that fund or that plan 6-7 years ago, I think Parnell administration. And I believe that totaled $3 billion. Is that approximately correct?
It was $1 billion for PERS and $2 billion for TERS.
Thank you. Is that what fixed it? Is that what made this possible to project out that the plan will work and meet expectations down the road, that deposit?
It helped.
Yeah. I mean, I'm answering my own question. I believe it did. So I guess my final question would be, ultimately, does the state of Alaska have a legal obligation to be the safety net for HB 79 if something goes wrong?
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, they do.
Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Through the chair, remind me, if you could, the unfunded liability was at $11 billion, and we paid down the three, leaving it at eight, and that reduced our sort of annual amortized amount substantially. So how did we get from eight to five? Can you remind me how that happened? Is it just stock performance?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it's been a number of different things that have done this. In the health side, there's been the implementation of the AGWIP program that the division started January of last year. It's been a significant savings. We've also recognized savings through one of our third-party administrators for medication. So that's been a big savings. We've seen cost reductions for medical costs. In terms of the pension side, we don't have those mechanisms in place. Basically, with the pension side, we have to fund. We don't have a lot of other options that we can do to change things like we did with health. So we're on a path. That's part of our funding policy that we have with the additional state contribution. And so those steps are in place there. We've seen, I would say, a big increase in our health side, and we will have a presentation. We're working with the House Finance Committee to have a PERS and TERS update probably within the next few weeks, that we can walk through all those things for you.
Follow up.
So this $100 million, essentially in scenario one and two, that would constitute, if I've got this right, at the most, about a 2% increase to the unfunded liability?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, these are just for the additional state contribution. These aren't additions to the unfunded liability. These are amounts to pay down the unfunded liability.
Okay. Follow up? I mean, I understand that as an accounting matter, they're different things, but I guess I'm treating them as sort of the same because they're state dollars. And I guess I'm feeling some confidence in the legislation in that this is a 20-year span, and I'm thinking of the benefit of the bill, and that relative or in relation to the remainder of the unfunded liability, it doesn't look like a great burden, in particular with Mr. Kirshner's assurances about its sustainability and viability. Do you have any thoughts on any of that?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson. Nope. As an accountant, I'm looking at the dollars flowing in or flowing out, and based on the plan that we have in place, this would increase additional state contributions, the request that we would have to the House and the Senate for funds to get deposited into the plans.
So maybe to your question, Representative Josephson, this program could be considered a pilot program for other employees that are in our retirement system. And I guess my question would be, if this was expanded beyond this population, then the cost of the program just with these numbers would increase because of the employer's involvement in our unfunded liability. Would that be accurate?
To the chair, I believe that would be accurate, yes.
Does that make sense? Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask that question, which is there an economy of scale in that if you multiply the population times 10 or something like that, the risk might go up, but could the benefit go up? And I guess my question is, at some point I thought the plan was cost neutral, and I see the additional increase, and that increase is not paying down the unfunded liability because that's, you know, I guess I need a primer in this because I'm thrown in the middle of a lot of this terminology, and I haven't really taken the 101, and I'm in the 401, so that's the problem. But two questions. Was there a scenario where this was cost neutral, where people pay in and forget about the unfunded liability, because that, to me, is history. That was a problem incurred from a change of plans that we're now paying for currently for people that retired under, that got hired under a different plan. So forget about unfunded liability. If paying into this plan and then getting a pension when you're 55 after 20 years or more of work, is that in any scenario cost neutral? Because I see the increase due to HB 79, and it takes 20 years to be a zero in that column.
Maybe, yeah.
Representative Wohl, HB 79 itself at this point is cost neutral because it has levers built into it to address any unfunded liability, and it is starting out very well funded because obviously there's nobody ready to retire right this minute. And we've heard from Mr. Kirshner that over time, as those levers come into use, it would take some real extraordinary circumstances for this plan to start accruing unfunded liability to any extent. That said, it could happen, but this plan, HB 79 itself, can be termed cost neutral, but its effects on the unfunded liability and who pays it is what we're demonstrating here. So instead of the employer paying, say, $50 and the state paying $100, the state's now going to pay $125 because there's fewer contributions and the employer's only paying $25.
Thank you. That's what I needed. Okay. So a follow-up to that, which would be the same question as Representative Johnston has. In the scenario where it's cost neutral with the available levers at hand, and if you take the population and instead of 5,000, you have 50,000 employees, is it the same risk, in that if the economy went south and you hit levers where the employees are actually contributing more, you could still remain cost neutral, but is there an economy of scale to offset any potential downturn in the economy? Is there more of a safety net with the larger employee base, or is it all the same?
I think we would need to defer to Mr. Kirshner on that, because my impression is that it would have a larger impact on what the state has to pay.
And Representative Wolf.
Yes. Yeah.
Mr. Kirshner?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay, yes, thank you. David Kirshner from Buck. A couple comments. First of all, when I hear cost neutral, I think no additional cost to the state. And as shown in our in the fiscal note, there is an additional cost to the state. So HB 79 is not cost neutral. HB 79 itself, the funding of the HB 79 trust is self-contained. But as we saw from the pie charts, and as Kathy Lee just mentioned, $25 less is coming from the employers to pay down the unfunded liability in the pension plan. That unfunded liability in the pension plan still has to be paid down. So now that $25 has to come from the state rather than coming from the employers. So it's not cost neutral in the sense of looking at the total spend of the state toward these benefits. The cost will increase. That's why the additional state contribution increases. From a risk perspective, as the DB plan gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the liabilities get bigger and bigger, and so the risk to the state, as the plan gets larger, and if assets don't do well, or we adopt more conservative assumptions about future experience, which increases liabilities, either way, the risk is higher to the plan, to the state, when the DB plan is larger, because there's more, the liabilities are larger, the assets are larger, so when we lose 10% of our assets, we lose a larger piece. That larger piece then has to be made up over, based on the ARM board's funding policy, that piece has to be made, that shortfall has to be made up over a 25-year period.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Representative, Madam Chair. I think I understand all that. I guess my last question would be, since the population of tier 1, 2, 3 retirees that are getting medical benefits is diminishing over time, and that's basically where the unfunded liability resides. I'm assuming that unfunded liability is for people that are that are retired and receiving the benefit, and people aren't paying in the same way. So given that that is sort of a defined quantity that diminishes over time, wouldn't expanding the employee base help? Wouldn't it help deal with that unfunded liability as there's a lot more people paying in?
Well, certainly, yes. Certainly, as the plan population, if the plan population expands, that means payroll is expanding, and that means two things are happening. One is benefits expected to be paid from the plan are increasing because there's more people to pay benefits to, so the liabilities increase. But then because payroll is increasing, more contributions are coming in from both the members as well as the employers. So that's a good thing. That helps generate more money coming in from in terms of contributions. But as I said, as the plan, so expanding payroll helps in that sense. But when the plan becomes large, as the plan's assets and liabilities are larger and larger, give a certain percentage decline in one of those amounts is a larger dollar amount, which then has to be made up, and that's why the risk to the state is larger as the DB plan gets larger.
Okay. Yeah. Well, last one. Yeah, I keep saying that though. But I understand the larger employee base, the more benefits and all that, but the medical benefits are not continuing, and that's a lot of the, I'm assuming that's a big part of the unfunded liability, which is an increasing cost, where just the pension alone, if this plan was in a vacuum, would be self-sustaining. It's the unfunded liability component that adds the extra cost, and since the new plan does not have medical, I would think that over time, having a larger base paying into it, and I guess the other offshoot is potentially keeping employees retained longer, and I don't know if that how that affects things other than operating smoother operations, but anyhow. Confusing myself.
Representative Wolf, through the chair, I would like to clarify one thing because I've heard that twice here today that this plan has no medical benefits. It does have medical benefits.
I mean, for retirees.
It does have medical benefits for retirees, and it does have a health reimbursement arrangement to help them pay for the premiums that they receive. And another thing is right now the retiree health plan is 100% funded. It's the pension side that is unfunded.
And if you remember, we had the Department of Administration up as they walked us through, and we'll have them again as far as the savings. No, we even did it this year. Savings as far as the health plans for retirees. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is getting to what Representative Wolf just ended up with. And I'm not sure who the question's for other than just to kind of put it out there. But you, Madam Chair, mentioned that this may be looked at as a pilot program. There might be some interest in trying to expand this to other labor groups, teachers, whatever. But what Representative Wool pointed out is that there is a cost savings element to this when we get to the idea of retaining more of our employees, we get to the idea of not spending as much money on recruitment, training, those kinds of things. But is there any way, when we're looking at a cost-benefit analysis of this, is there anything in place anywhere statewide that would track what those savings are year to year? That's my question, so that we could use that as a part of our cost-benefit analysis as well. That's my question.
Yeah, and that might be something that we could ask Department of Administration. You have to understand, though, that this is also a plan for the employers, so you would be talking to municipalities.
Right.
In fact, the majority, as we were talking about in our exchange here, are employers versus actual state employees. right. for this plan. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, for any of the five or six who can handle this the best, I'm surprised to learn that the HRA is fully funded and that the liability is the cash pension portion, because I thought that was part of the reason why the authors of House Bill 79 declined to, of course, an HRA is different than these generous medical benefits that tiers one through three get, but I thought the idea behind the bill, in part, there are many ideas, was to not seek the health benefits because they were the more unpredictable part of the overall package. And so it's a little counterintuitive to hear, oh, no, the HRA is fully funded and under control. And someone
would you like to address that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, sections 26 through 29 talk about the eligibility for medical benefits and the premium payment for those benefits. So there are medical benefits in this plan, but these are the same medical benefits that are in place for defined contribution members, not the legacy plans that are in place for the tiers 1, 2, and 3 in PERS. And then I will let Mr. Worley talk about the 100% funding that we're seeing in the health plan.
Right. But if I could, just to follow up on that, I thought we just learned that the legacy plans are not – the unfunded liability is not a consequence of the legacy plans, health plans. I thought I just heard that a couple minutes ago. So I'm wondering why the authors of the bill said, we're not going there with those generous legacy plans. We're going to stick with the DC plan.
And I can't speak for the authors, but one of the difference in this employee pool is that these employees usually start in their early 20s, and because of the nature of the business, they're usually done in 20 years. So their insurance from maybe 45 to 55 could be an additional cost.
And to the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not sure if you're talking about two different things. You're talking about HRA being 100% funded. And the HRA is the health reimbursement arrangement, so that is a defined contribution dollar amount that's put into a fund. That's different than the defined benefit health care trust that is over 100% funded. Those are two separate things.
Yeah, I'm aware. Thank you.
Yep.
And would you like to have Representative Kopp up to speak to this, or you?
Yes, I would.
Yes. Thank Representative you. Kopp?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Chuck Kopp, representative for House District 24. To the question, Representative Josephson, so under House Bill 79, you would not be eligible for your health savings account benefit until you had 25 years of service. So you'd have to, even though it's 20 years of service, but you have to wait till you're 55 years of age if you wanted to get that medical benefit sooner. Let's say you retired at 44, as Representative Johnston said, you could start early, but still have to wait to get the benefit. You'd have to work a full 25 years just to be eligible to access your health savings account, and then that is meant for you still for you to go out and buy your own plan to bridge you to Medicare. That's how that works. And Madam Chair, I would also, just the great question that several representatives have touched on with respect to retention and the value of that. The municipalities that have testified have said that for a firefighter, 3 years in, the training value that they have into some agencies, it exceeds $1 million. And to train them and certify them, especially if they're giving them advanced training, sending them to paramedic school, to have that walk away is devastating to the municipalities. We had the North Pole fire chief that has lost 26 employees in several years and said that he literally does not have anybody to promote into anything. All he's getting is basic firefighter certification training, and then they're going away. So when we look at the total increase to the state of $3 million under scenario one, 3.4 under both scenario two, that increase, some municipalities are suffering that just in one agency. So I would say that orders of magnitude larger are being lost by municipalities due to the retention crisis. Even with a significant increase in pay the troopers had, they were able to increase their recruiting, but their retention is still the same issue. When they declared a crisis with being 40 positions down, they're still about 40 positions down. So we are talking about retention. Money helps get you in the door, but a plan, a retirement plan, is critical. And these numbers, when we look at the loss to municipalities, are just minutia compared to what our collective municipalities. And there's more than 100 letters in here from fire and police chiefs that will kind of document the point I'm making about the loss.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for that, Representative Kopp. Is there a way to specifically track that so that 7 years from now, if we see some sort of downturn and, things are growing out of hand this way, is there a way that we could track how much savings has been made over that time period to say that, you know, we shouldn't just immediately throw the baby out with the bathwater until we see what the real benefits were to the state and to local municipalities with this kind of a plan?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, so most agencies track their employee attrition. I mean, they just do. That would be very easy to see how attrition has changed as a result of this plan. That would be something the state could track. And we didn't make it be part of the bill. Like we do often, you know, we have these, assessment or study groups, but it would be an easy thing for the state to track to see if it affects retention.
Thank you.
And while we have you up here, would Mr. Tuitt like to do a sectional?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp, and the good news is this bill only has 39 sections in it. The even better news is that there's only 11 that are substantive, and with your indulgence, I'll just cover the 11 substantive sections.
That would be great.
Okay. But I could do 39. But, okay. All right, here we go. Section 1, starting on page 3, and we covered this on Monday when we talked about the changes from the last committee substitute on lines 6 through 9, there on page 3. This is one of the plan enhancement, plan asset enhancement adjustments that Representative Kopp mentioned. So this is putting into place the mechanisms for the ARM board to increase both employer contributions and any additional adjustments if those levers need to be activated. And that works in conjunction with Section 2 on page 4, lines 23 through 26, as well as line 17. You can see the new language in bold and underline. These are basically all working together for those particular adjustment mechanisms. The next major change is on Section 12, page 9. And the changes in between page 4 and page 9 are technical and conforming changes to insert the new bill sections that are being added, or statutory sections that are being added by this bill. So page 9, section 12, this actually is the creation of the new plan. And as we mentioned on Monday, you'll never see the term Tier 5 in the bill anywhere. What you'll see is on line 9, combination of line 5 and line 9, who are first hired, I'm sorry, line 9, first hired after June 30, 2006. That's kind of the designation of when this employee group will start. Then in section 13 right below it, this has to do with the employee contributions under the plan. And you can see on lines 28, that's the 8% of the, which is a new amount for employees. That's what the employee share of the contribution will be to this plan. And page 15, or not page 15, section 15 on the next page, page 10, we addressed this on Monday in our explanation of changes as well. Line 13, the changes here are just to capture that the total employer contribution will be 22%. And this was language that, again, that Ms. Lee and Mr. Worley requested get into this particular bill version, just to make clear that this plan is still continuing the 22% employer contribution. Moving on, section 18 on page 11, over on the next page, this is another one of the plan asset enhancement adjustments. We also covered this on Monday in our explanation of changes. Subsection I and subsection J just contain the formulas for the contributions amounts that you saw on the pie charts that Mr. Kirshner addressed. This section is what defines that. And the next major change is section 19, page 11 on the next page. This is the start of what we refer to as plan savings. It's the plan's new medical benefit, and it, as Ms. Lee was mentioning, it's the same as tier 4. I'm ahead of myself. Right, and that's, section 19, and this is a pretty important change, but it's how the bill is accomplishing using the Tier 4 medical plan. It's separating out the tiers 1 through 3 and saying that those all are continuing in the trust that they're a part of. This plan will be a part of the Tier 4 trust. And I know we're calling for amendments. This potentially could change in a new version, because in conversations that we've had with Mr. Worley and Ms. Lee about exactly where and how we're going to put the contributions of this plan might be slightly different than what's reflected in this bill. But right now we're talking about creating a separate trust for this. This particular section in the bill assumes that we're putting it into the existing Tier 4 health reimbursement arrangement trust, if that makes sense. But we're talking about potentially creating another trust, so we'll need some different statutory language to accomplish that. That's more conversations for myself and Mr. Worley and Ms. Lee. Section 21 on the next page, page 12, this is one of the features that we're calling a cost-saving feature, and this just sets the age of retirement there. You can see on line 7, 60 years with 5 years of service, or number 2 there on line 9, age 55 with 20 years of experience. The next change is on the next page, section 25, and we're getting into what Ms. Lee just, I'm getting ahead of myself. We mentioned this in our explanation of changes on Monday as well. This is the post-retirement pension adjustment, or the inflation proofing. This is the benefit reduction tool. If the plan gets to be underperforming by 10%, this is put in where that benefit will go away until the plan recovers. The next major change is section 28, pages 14 through 15, and this again is continuing the creation of the new medical plan, which will be the same as the Tier 4 plan. This particular statute is the Tiers 1 through 3 medical plan, so we're just creating a carve-out for this particular group and this particular plan. Since they're partly in the pension for the retirement benefit, but they're going to be in the Tier 4 medical benefit, so we're making this plan will exist in the pension sections of the PERS statutes, but anywhere where we're moving them over to the Tier 4 for the health plan, we're carving that out of the PERS Tiers 1 through 3 statutes and directing you to the new medical plan. And the new medical plan is the very next section on Section 29, page 15. This is essentially nearly identical to the current Tier 4 statute with a few changes to just technically make room for this being a new starting plan. So Sections A and B are new. And then F section, subsections F, G, and H are also kind of new features that are needed to start up a new plan, but the rest of the sections in this particular new statute in Section 29 are identical to the Tier 4 medical plan. And the last major change is Section 30, pages 17 through 18. This is also a cost savings feature. And here you can see that this is the formula for your average retirement income is spread out over 5 years, as opposed to Tiers 1 through 3, which were 3 years. The rest of the changes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, are either conforming changes or they are starting on Section 5, kind of all of the technical transition provisions of how you move. If you're a current employee in Tier 4, how you will move into this new plan should it pass, those you'll find in Section 35, and they cover 3 or 4 pages, and it defines how the formula is going to be calculated as to what your buy-in will be, details like that. And I think Section 39 at the very end reflects we're now in 2020 right now instead of 2019 when the bill was introduced, so it would become effective in 2021.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have some notes from last year when we heard this bill, and I show a first year of training for firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics is more than $130,000 a year, and the average cost to train a public safety employee is nearly $200,000 a year. So my question for Mr. Kirshner would be, do you assume better retention under this HB 79 plan than we did under Tier 4?
Tier 4.
I'm sorry, could you, do we have any increased retention? Is that?
Are you assuming better retention with HB 79 than you are with the current Tier 4 plan?
Oh, yes, thank you for that clarification. Yes, we are. Once the participants are assumed to transfer into the defined benefit plan, they are now subject to the assumptions that we use regarding termination of employment that apply to the defined benefit plan participants. And as you would expect, one of the differences between a defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan is generally there's less incentive to stick around when you have a defined contribution plan versus a defined benefit plan. So the termination rates, which are what we expect people to leave employment between now and potentially retiring, the termination rates are lower in the defined benefit plan, which means we are projecting more people will stick around and ultimately receive a benefit under HB 79 than we're currently expecting under the defined contribution retirement plan.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for the panel here, I'm remembering that, and if you'd like to comment on this, you have in the past, but in a sense, we're being treated like the Farm League and we're training folks and they're being poached. And presumably they have to prove themselves at the next academy in King County or whatever, but they do well, I bet. And this is just an endless cycle. Is that, I think that's the essence of what you reported from the North Slope.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. There's a letter in the packet. There's at least five police and probably seven fire chiefs that said exactly that. And they're losing them to out-of-state departments that are offering significant cash incentives for lateral hire because they look at their training resume and, you know, if someone has all these licenses and certifications, they don't have to pay for that. So it's a significant cause for them to be recruiting our people, yes.
Representative Ortiz.
Going back to that, the cost of losing people, since the state went from the Tier 3 or the Tier 4, which is still defined benefit, correct? Tier 4 is still defined benefit? No, Tier 3. This is. Do we have we tracked how much of an increase we've seen in loss of employees amongst public safety workers since we transitioned from Tier 3 to Tier 4?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, so every department, I think there's like 50-some departments that have offered letters, have certainly their own story to tell on that, that they're mm-hmm. tracking that. And what the common theme that emerges is they have a ever-widening age gap of employees. They have very young ones cycling in and out between 2 and 3 and 4 years of service. And then they have all their 15 years and more employees. And they have a huge age gap there. And what they're saying is that they're losing their mentors and their trainers and their supervisors to retirement. And the young ones are not promoting up into these positions because they're leaving. So they have this age and experience gap. And it's almost like an artificial divide that's growing in the agencies, very young and senior.
Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that can't be stated enough. If we can see the contribution columns, but I think what can't be stated enough is the effect it's having on retaining quality help, as you guys have stated many times. I just want to go back to a point that was made earlier that and Representative Jessen touched upon, and I'm still kind of trying to figure it out, but that the medical aspect of, and maybe this is a question for the retirement specialist over here, but of the tiers 1, 2, and 3, and the reason it was discontinued was due to the cost, I'm assuming, and the cost, the pension is very predictable, and you know what the arithmetic is there, but the medical was what cost, and the acceleration of those costs, I thought, was what made those plans unaffordable. And I just heard previously that, no, the medical was paid for, but it's the pension that isn't. So I guess I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
So, through the chair, so we had really poor actuarial advice, if you recall, which got us into the mess that we were in. But you are correct that health care is a significant driver of pensions. We know in our teachers' retirement system, our actuarials from the school districts have told us health care is driving the cost of education. We've been told that over and over, so it's no different here.
And just to that, it was before the $3 billion pay down, it was almost a third, where PERS was the largest unfunded part of the liability and TERS was next, but the health care was almost a third also. But there has been a lot of cost savings done by the Department of Administration that has made a huge difference in that. I think we're all supposed to be taking our Kleenexes over to the Terry Miller building. And so it's my intention to hold this. Amendment deadlines is Friday, March 6th at 5 p.m. And our next meeting is Thursday, March 5th, 2020, and it will be delayed until 15 minutes after the House floor adjourns tomorrow because we will be gaveling on the floor at 9. The agenda for tomorrow is intensive management surcharge and repeal of term date, extended seismic hazard safeties commission, and we've added to the schedule the naming of the Irene Weber Bridge. And remember, we were going to get some clarification on the fiscal note and HB 159 medical education program. So it'll be HB 230, HB 197, HB 186, and HB 159. Do members have anything before they take their Kleenex over to the Terry Malibu? Okay, with that, this meeting's adjourned, and the time is 3:21.